If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Major, commissioning editor here at The Independent, and this is Double Take, a podcast in which our writers come into the studio to read and discuss one of their opinion pieces. It could be their weekly column or something from the archives that shines some light on this week's news. Today is going to be a little bit different as we're jumping straight into the discussion part of this week's show, as we don't want to waste a minute. We're joined by Richard Power Said, author of 1997, The Future That Never Happened. A look at why that year was a turning point for British culture and society, away from a fairer, brighter future and onto the path to our current malaise. And, as you might guess, on the other side of that debate is our chief political commentator, John Rentoul, author of Tony Blair, a Prime Minister. So thank you for joining us today, Richard.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. So you have a new book out, which is 1997, The Future That Never Happened.
I do indeed.
That's John's favourite year, isn't it? So we also have John Rentoul with us.
Things can only get better.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
Yeah, absolutely. So 97 was this year of extraordinary hope and promise. It was Tony Blair coming to power. It was the Spice Girls being the biggest band in the world, but, you know, a feminist band. It was, in terms of what New Labour was up to, it was, kind of finally people were paying attention to the Stephen Lawrence campaign. It really seemed like that was going to be, quote unquote, a watershed for race relations. That's the phrase people used to use. Of course, you know, there was this awful tragedy of Princess Diana dying, but it really seemed like Tony Blair was gonna, you know, take advantage of that and use it to modernize the monarchy. It seemed like there was going to be this potentially kind of more egalitarian relationship between the citizens and the establishment. And, you know, that was even there in things like Britpop. You know, Britpop had been really cool for a few years, but now it was exploding into, it was completely mainstream. You had Noel Gallagher going to parties with Tony Blair. It was a moment of hope, but things didn't really work out so well. So it's a book about that extraordinary optimistic time, and it's about why there was something potentially quite reactionary at the heart of that and why things went so wrong in the last 20 years.
And what was the reactionary element of it for you?
Well, I mean, partly it's about New Labour being like fundamentally extremely unambitious, and then partly it's about the way that they often took advantage of radical ideas and radical people. And this wasn't just New Labour. You know, it was a whole broader culture that was very much embracing radicalism, but very superficially, bringing it into the mainstream, really defanging it, stopping it from achieving the kind of fundamental changes that were really necessary. And I think that's part of why people now are so angry and so resentful, and why we're experiencing enormous upheaval.
And John, unambitious? Is that a term you apply to New Labour?
Well, I couldn't disagree with Richard more. I mean, because, you know, I mean, 1997 was a very significant year. It was a very significant change. And the Labour government achieved very significant things. I mean, the fact that, you know, some of them didn't work out very well doesn't mean they weren't worth trying. And the fact that we've ended up with Brexit is, to do with long-term historical forces and actually underlines the point that that New Labour was built on, which is that Britain is a very conservative country, and if you want to be electorally successful in Britain, you do have to recognise that. You have to start with the British people and where they are and build from that. And I think New Labour did that extremely successfully for 13 years.
What do you think the most successful thing about New Labour was then, or the most radical thing?
Well, transforming the public sphere, renewing public services, and transforming gay rights, women's equality, and making people feel comfortable with a mixed cultural society. I think all those are huge steps forward, which, you know, it may be that I'm just very old and so I see the glasses half full, and Richard is very young and sees the glasses half empty. But for me, you know, 1997 was the end of a long period of Labour being in the wilderness, and the period after that was a period of modest social democratic achievement. And, you know, obviously people like Richard were disappointed by the high hopes that they had in 97. And I think that that those high expectations were in the end the cause of a lot of the unhappiness with New Labour that's happened since.
We were sold a dream that didn't quite work out. Is that how you feel?
Well, I mean, I think you're right that maybe it can be unfair on any politician to project such extreme and intense hopes onto them and then to be disappointed when they don't turn out to be perfect. I mean, that's completely true. You know, I will admit that, you know, sometimes this debate becomes extremely polarized in a way that actually maybe doesn't reflect kind of how people really feel. So, you know, people on the left, people like myself, you know, while not denying New Labour's successes, because I don't think that most people on the left do, they do make, you know, what is sometimes a polemical argument that focuses on the many, many failures. And that's what I do, because those failures had a huge impact. And, you know, perhaps really crucially, it seems clear to me that the solutions that we need now are not those of New Labour. Indeed, the solutions we needed in 97 were not those of New Labour either. And I want to warn people away from thinking that somehow that kind of extremely mild, you know, quote unquote, social democracy with some very reactionary elements, the idea that that is the solution. And people on the Labour right similarly make a polemical argument that only acknowledges the successes and gets very upset about any mention of the failures, and tries to use that analysis of the past to support policies that have not worked and are not going to work now. So, as I think everyone knows, when we're talking about New Labour and 97, we're also talking about what we should be doing now.
And that's very topical, because actually today, John and I, we've been talking about a blog by Luke Akehurst about how to get rid of momentum. And his whole point is, actually, momentum's going to be a really big failure. They've gone as far as they can. Peak momentum was his phrase, I think.
Yeah.
And actually, we need to get back to proper social democratic values, and the hard left have hijacked the centre-left policies. But I think what Richard's saying here is, those policies are kind of defunct and didn't work first time round. Would you agree?
Well, no, of course I wouldn't agree with that. No, I think those policies did work the first time round, but I think obviously you have to move beyond them. I mean, the whole point about New Labour was permanent revisionism. I mean, that was what it was about. And Tony Blair actually said, I remember him saying, you know, someday some guys are going to come along and say, you've been doing it all wrong, and this is how we ought to achieve the ends for which the Labour Party was founded, which is what New Labour was doing. Jeremy Corbyn's come along with a very different model for achieving those similar ends. And I think what you're talking about, Luke Akehurst's article, I think his point is that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is going to be succeeded by someone from the so-called soft left, from the middle of the party, not someone with Jeremy Corbyn's politics exactly, but certainly not someone who, from the old New Labour politics either. My point is that, you know, I don't think Labour is going to go back to New Labour. I think it will go on to something else, which will be some kind of synthesis between what New Labour stood for and what Jeremy Corbyn stands for.
Do you think that we'll reach a synthesis, or do you want a Labour Party which fully rejects the sort of marketisation forces which took hold under Blair?
I mean, the reason that the soft left would potentially have the leadership and therefore control of the party after Corbyn would be that the right leader was there at the right time. And, you know, for those who are not optimistic about Jeremy Corbyn's chances of becoming prime minister sometime in the next 5 years, well then, I think it's probably quite clear that the people who would potentially succeed him are those who are either of the soft left or who are willing to pretend to be. I think we can all imagine who I'm talking about here. and those individuals are exceptional political operators. But actually, I think there are lots of reasons for thinking that Jeremy Corbyn can win the next election, in which case you're going to see not just a transformed Labour Party, you're going to see a transformed Britain.
Well, that is, of course, where I differ from you again, because, you know, that would be to mislearn all the lessons of history since 1997. I mean, the point about, New Labour is that, you know, if you think that you can build a Labour Party on rejecting everything that New Labour stood for and everything it achieved, then I think you're heading for disaster, because I think a government built on that kind of politics would be very bad for the country. It would lead to economic disaster and meltdown quite quickly.
I wonder if we're slightly kind of confusing symbolism and rhetoric on the one hand, which can often, people like to talk about Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto as being revolutionary, because it kind of suits people on the left to say we're really going to transform things, and it suits people on the right to say this is terrifying, don't go anywhere near it.
The manifesto was a terrible I thought it was a terrible manifesto, which actually did very little for inequality, and I thought that, you know, if you actually cared about inequality, you should have voted Lib Dem last time. But your problem with 97 is that it wasn't transformational enough, and you're saying that what we need is a politics that is transformational, that somehow abolishes the market and transforms Britain into a socialist society.
I'm saying we can abolish the market.
Well, good. In that case, then we can have a sensible debate about social democratic reform and how to progress, and we can get back to what New Labour was doing, with obviously new methods and new policies for new times.
So I think what Corbyn represents is a decisive shift against marketization and towards not just state intervention, but also cooperative economic structures. And that's, for a lot of people on the left, that's a first step.
Right. Richard, if you think that what was wrong with the New Labour government in 1997 was that we didn't have enough co-ops, then I'm sorry, but that's not going to work. There is not going to be a political groundswell of support from the British people for a government that's going to introduce more co-ops.
I don't think anybody's suggesting that cooperatives are a massive vote winner. What's being suggested is that they're an exceptionally egalitarian, democratic, and often very efficient way of organising economic life, which have been immensely successful across the world.
Which is why there aren't very many of them anywhere.
Well, co-ops aside,
in Southern European agriculture, across South America, there's lots in Northern Europe. Cooperative structures are extremely successful. And the point is that they root economic success in social justice.
And I think we're getting to the nitty-gritty of it, which is the relation to the market, because under New Labour, it opened the doors to the market as a way to develop revenue in its own opinion to help the welfare state.
No, it sought to control the market for the ends of social justice, which is what Labour, the Labour Party has always been about.
Apart from the
Marxist tendency of people who actually want to abolish the market, which I think is a waste of time. And would never win an election.
Now we're going to pause for an ad break before we jump back into the discussion.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You have a really interesting chapter in your book about this, about Gordon Brown and his relation with the banks and deregulation.
So I don't think that we could describe the relationship of New Labour to the city and to the financial services sector as being one of controlling the market. I think that very clearly what happened there, and this was, you know, this was following on from what the Tories had done, absolutely, it was only continuing a Tory policy, but it was about...
It was restraining the market what the Conservatives had done, because Thatcherism was all about unleashing market forces and privatisation and so on. New Labour came in imposing a one-off windfall levy on the privatised utilities, and making sure that the proceeds of a successful market economy were spent on renewing the public services, in particular the NHS. And Richard, if you think that doubling real spending on the NHS was a failure, then I'd hate to see what a Corbyn-type government success would look like.
Okay, so let's stick to financial services, because utilities and the windfall tax on that, however wonderful that was, are not very relevant to deregulation of the city. The point is that when the Bank of England reforms were undertaken, the FSA, the Financial Services Authority, was set up. They were specifically told, we know this because Adair Turner, the chair, told us this in the Economic Affairs Select Committee. Adair Turner said the FSA was there to be light touch. It was not supposed to oversee the broad corporate plans of any banks. So we know that in supervision of individual institutions was incredibly light touch, appallingly so, and that's why we didn't see RBS and Northern Rock as the immense dangers they were. And on the other hand, the systemic risk, so that's the risk that happens, that emerges when banks become codependent, because they're all lending so much to each other, and therefore one RBS or one Northern Rock can bring them all down. That systemic risk was left to the Bank of England. This is all in the 97 reforms that happened under Brown and Bulls and Alistair Darling. The Bank of England was left to look after this systemic risk. There was a culture of completely not caring about systemic risk in the bank, and actually in the Treasury as well. The Bank of England had no powers to deal with this. They were only allowed to publish a report every now and again, and they didn't care about doing so. So what you've got there is, after Thatcher and Major have deregulated the city, Brown and Bulls and Darling continue to do so. They do so in a way that, I mean, I don't want to do a kind of told you so, but the fact is there were a lot of people telling them, don't do this, it's incredibly dangerous.
And I don't think there were.
They were just on the left, and nobody listened to them because they were apparently old-fashioned and useless. And they turned out to be right. Yeah, they turned out to be correct.
No.
Because the crisis came from that collision of the systemic risk and the individual banks taking massive risks.
Yeah,
and you know, I'm happy if you want to kind of blame it all on Gordon Brown. Tony Blair supported it all. I don't care whose fault it is. The point is, that's where so much of the incredible damage that's been done to this country in the last 10 years comes from.
Well, I'm afraid you do sound just like a Tory. I mean, you're suggesting that
the financial crash was caused
by the Labour government in Britain.
No, I didn't say. I didn't say that. I said it was caused by deregulation throughout.
No, it happened in America and had knock-on effects here, which could not have been avoided, however well regulated the city had been. Obviously, the regulation was not perfect.
It didn't happen in other big financial centres, did they?
Well, because
they were so deregulated.
London is a much bigger financial centre, and that had been extremely successful for more than a decade.
We've become dependent upon that financial sector because of a highly financialised, highly leveraged, low-skill economy, which, again, is not New Labour's fault. It was something which was created by Thatcher, developed by Major, and never in any meaningful way undermined by Blair and Brown. Because of our lovely post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory, this nice idea of Gordon Brown's that we were going to just focus on developing high-skilled workers, and that was
precisely,
going to
which
trickle
is the opposite
down.
Of what you've just said, which is that we were running a low-skill economy,
but it didn't
with
work.
Highly
it didn't,
leveraged
no, the
finance,
point, no, no,
finance
it was
sector,
about focusing which, on a small number of high-skilled workers, and then the idea was that growth and productivity, that wealth would trickle down.
No. The idea that new labour was in favour of trickle down.
Trickle down economics is an insult
that you apply to conservatives. And it doesn't even apply to them because it's quite hard to find even an American conservative who would actually endorse the phrase, and to apply it to a Labour government in this country, I think is just wrong. I mean, that is not what anybody intended to do. That was not the economic model that New Labour was following. New Labour was following a supply side driven model of raising the education and training levels in this country in order to produce a more egalitarian outcome. The fact that they weren't as successful as you would have liked in terms of equality is a difficult question to do with the fact that, you know, modern economies have huge differential pressures built into into the earning structure. Obviously, the returns to higher education are increasing all the time. Therefore, you know, in my view, New Labour did extremely well to prevent inequality from rising.
It seems very clear to me that in the economies where you don't just have high skills concentrated in a very small number of people, as in ours, which is what this post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory is about, if you want to create an economy that where those high skills are spread much more
which is what
broadly,
New Labour did with more, expansion no, of the university sector.
Much, I mean, which, I think it's generally considered to have not been terrifically successful. The countries where you have that working much better are countries with strong trade unions. Because in a country with strong trade unions and labour regulation, which the state is forced to enact by those trade unions, you therefore have workers who can say to their bosses, "You've got to train me." Bosses can't get rid of their workers. They've got a financial interest in having highly skilled workers.
Which
if you don't have strong
these
trade unions, and Labour did not strengthen trade unions, which was an appalling mistake, and it was a disloyalty to the Labour movement. That's a fundamental way that you improve skills and therefore improve productivity. It's extraordinary that they didn't try to do that.
Well, yeah, except I'm afraid, you know, it's completely understandable given the history of the trade union movement in this country. I mean, I was alive in the 1970s when the economy hit the wall because of the breakdown of industrial relations, which was, you know, mostly, it has to be said, the trade union movement's fault. And you can understand why a Labour government would be sceptical about strengthening trade unions after that, but I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think successful trade union movements in Germany and some of the Nordic countries, you know, do work extremely well. But it's very difficult to import that culture into Britain.
So before we're going to round up now. Before we round up, I feel like we're all social democrats in the room, right? of different stripes. We're all social democrats. Is there a path that Labour is there something from the New Labour years that we can build on? Whether it was an unfulfilled promise or, in your opinion, John, an actual concrete policy, what do you think a Corbyn Labour government could build on, John?
Oh well, I think you've got to learn the right lessons from the disappointments that came after 97. And I my glass is half full. I think there was a lot of good was achieved, but you've got to learn that actually achieving a more equal society is much more difficult than it seems. That's what New Labour was trying to do, and the fact that it wasn't totally successful means that you have to think more cleverly about how to achieve it instead of rejecting the whole New Labour approach as flawed.
Richard?
Where do I start with this? I think that if we ask ourselves, where are many of the radical demands in Britain coming from now? They're coming from a lot of the time from young people who grew up under New Labour and were, in a sense, given aspirations by New Labour. Not the kinds of aspirations that we're talking about, kind of Mondeo man, but rather the aspirations of, we believe that a multicultural society, a society where women and gay people are respected, a society where migrants are not subject to enormous hatred and scapegoating, we believe that society is possible. And the disappointment of that society having not actually emerged motivates a great deal of the demands for radical change that we're hearing now. So I think that, you know, New Labour's existence has a lot to do with those radical changes, but it's one of disappointment.
Okay, thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening. Please rate, review and subscribe on iTunes, Acast or wherever else you get your podcasts. Helen Hodnoff produced this episode. I'm Kirsty Major. See you next week.